I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. 2 years into the Arab Spring, the question, what is to become of Egypt, the most important, perhaps the only nation in the Ummah, the Islamic community? Egypt, tossed most recently by turmoil that is very consistent with the turmoil of 2 years ago. It now has an elected government, an elected parliament, an elected president, Mohamed Morsi. What of Morsi and his face to the West and his face to the Muslim Brothers? He comes from the Muslim Brothers. Raymond Stock, writing most recently in the Foreign Policy Research Institute, measures Mr. Morsi, and one of the fresh ways to do it is a proverb or a story from Egyptian lore about a camel and a donkey. Raymond, a very good evening to you. The camel and the donkey, what does this say to us about Mr. Morsi and how he has presented his first two years of the Arab Spring? Good evening.
Hi. Well, there is, in fact, a tendency in Egypt, in probably in Arab society in general, but particularly in Egypt, I've heard it, where people will compare a far-sighted leader to a camel. A camel is a creature that gazes serenely at the horizon as it plods imperturbably towards its goal, whereas a donkey is an animal which looks down at the ground, hesitates, and is not sure where it's going. And for that reason, Hosni Mubarak was frequently, you know, accused of being like a donkey. But here we have a situation where the donkey really was the camel, because Mubarak saw what would follow him, and he warned us, he warned our president, he warned the world that when he fell, he would be followed by chaos and by rule of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the little parable I want to, the little story you were referring to about the donkey specifically, is whether or not you should believe what people tell you. And that's the point of it. And what happens is there's a man named Goha. Goha is a sort of an everyman character in Arabic and even Turkish, Iranian, general Middle Eastern literature. He's sort of a wise fool. And one day he goes off to do his errands with a donkey he borrowed from his neighbors. But during the course of the day, he falls in love with the donkey. He finds it so useful and so friendly and affectionate that he doesn't want to part with it. So when he comes home, he tells the neighbors that he's lost the donkey. The donkey's run away. And he can't find it. But actually, he secreted the donkey in his barn. And the neighbors weep and wail and are so terribly upset that they've lost their donkey. It takes them a while to finally go off to sleep. And when they finally do, in the middle of the night, there comes this braying from Goha's barn. It's their donkey. So they excitedly they wake up and go running over to his house, and they say, "Goha, Goha, wake up. Our donkey, he's returned. Can't you hear him?" He says, "No, I don't hear a donkey." "Yes, you can just hear him braying right now. He's in our barn, in your barn. Please, go get him. He's home." He says, no, you crazy people. Do you tell me that you believe the donkey and you don't believe me?"
We're dealing with a governance now that is non-transparent, Raymond. And these parables and proverbs and images of leaders are very much in play. Because the question you raise in your piece is Mohamed Morsi smarter than President Obama, just as Mubarak was smarter than Mohamed Morsi and the Egyptian people 2 years ago? Right now, the support that Morsi enjoys is not just Washington, but also in a recent embassy to Europe. And we know the IMF is pledging funds, and he will be traveling to Paris. Does he represent a far-viewing camel? Because he sees, no matter how he fails at home, the Europeans and the Americans will support him.
Yes, we are the donkeys in that story. Our governments and world leaders in general are the donkeys in this story. And also the many specialists and other experts and various government bureaucrats and the media particularly are all the donkeys in this story. But actually, our government, whatever its actual view of Mohamed Morsi, I do think that they have some idea of how really bad he is. But they still put their money on him, and they're continuing to back him. And they basically have bet the farm on Mohamed Morsi going along with their program. But what is their real program? We don't really know, because I think that President Obama himself has a different vision of the Middle East than has existed previously in our foreign policy. He's not as pro-Israel as the previous presidents. He has no actual feeling for Israel. Therefore, he doesn't really mind that they hate Israel. It doesn't bother him. He's only concerned if he can control their most egregious behavior. He also believes that the Muslim Brotherhood is a bulwark against more extreme, he apparently believes this, the more extreme elements in the Islamist movement. But in fact, they are the same. They're simply following a different strategy. And they're using us, and they've ridden our donkey into power. So what do we do? We're giving Egypt 20 F-16s. We're giving them 200 Abrams tanks that are actually built inside Egypt with our assistance. This is all part of our foreign aid, our military aid package, which is about $1.5 to $1.6 billion per year, which is uninterrupted and is obviously being even expanded. It's envisioned to be expanded now, possibly by up to another billion or $1.5 billion, and it's coming near, perhaps even more. He's also, as you noted, going to other sources. They're also giving him money to the IMF. Though it's delayed, it's Sloan is definitely still on track. And so is the European Union giving him perhaps $5 billion now in emergency aid. Qatar and Saudi Arabia are giving him many billions of dollars. He's got a $3 billion request into the Chinese for help with his nuclear program, which, by the way, is quite dangerous as well, potentially. And then also Iran is offering to assist in that program. So we have such a perfect storm of idiocy. And John Kerry was recently grilled by Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, about the need to send, the wisdom of sending these F-16s and Abrams tanks and everything to Egypt. And he just kept repeating the usual line that we're still dealing with a government that respects the peace treaty and which we can rely upon to do what's needed in this area. And actually, that is no longer the case. Even though he is cooperating in a superficial sense, he is actually subverting the whole process. He won the ceasefire for Gaza, for Hamas recently back in November that is actually favorable to Hamas. We outsourced our diplomacy to him. And the day after that, he declared himself supreme dictator, more or less. He issued a decree which canceled all other powers in the country, gave himself power greater than any pharaoh ever had, including Mubarak. That led to a huge uprising that has not yet quieted down. In fact, it's increasing. There are more people now demonstrating, probably now more demonstrating against Morsi than ever demonstrated against Mubarak.
You tell the story in your recent piece of a victorious Abbasid commander, Abu al-Abbas Abdullah. This is the year 750, June of 750, and he invites the surviving 80 surviving members of his rival family, the Umayyad family. He invites them to a banquet near Jaffa, and he serves the meal. And while the princes, his enemies, his supporters, are eating, the assassins come in, slaughter them all, and then they throw leather covers over the dead and continue the meal. You tell that story because is this a story of a knee slapper when you tell the story in Cairo? Do the Egyptians enjoy the irony?
I think everyone sort of gets a delicious sense of irony out of that story. It's also a chillingly delicious sense of irony out of that story. But you can only recite it with fear that it won't happen to you one day. And I really think that we're in for that. If we continue down the course our government has chosen, we will be in for this. Because they're not only working in these countries abroad, they're also working in our own country. This is an international organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, and its allies. There are many different jihadist organizations who work together as a network. But the Muslim Brotherhood is the largest, the oldest, and the most dangerous, in my opinion, because it is the most covert.
Raymond, would we support the Muslim Brothers without Egypt? In supporting Egypt, we're supporting the Muslim Brothers. I'm wondering if we're being fooled because of our obsession about nation states.
I think that we're being fooled by them every day, and I think that we have the assumption that many experts and media folks and our government has taken since the beginning of the Arab Spring, so-called, it's really the Islamist Spring, is that once in power, Islamists, no matter how radical they may sound in their own internal discourse, and they are extremely radical in their internal discourse, they, and all of them are, they will somehow you know, rise to the when they shoulder the burdens of responsibility that they come with power and rule, they will moderate. They will be forced to face certain realities, such as feeding their people, meeting the needs of, you know, international security, et cetera, that are imposed upon them. In fact, they will just use their position of power to further their own goals, without respect to the health or safety of their population, the prosperity of their people. Their primary goal is to achieve their religious ideologies' ends, which are to reestablish the caliphate and to establish once and for all the dominance of Islam over the earth.
Raymond Stock is writing most recently in the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He is a Shulman Ginsberg Writing Fellow at the Middle East Forum. We're waiting for Bonaparte to become Queen Victoria. It's a long wait. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.